I'm Alexis Dion.
And I'm Chelsea.
And we're the co-hosts of High Priority, a podcast where we ask industry experts the tough questions about the past, present, and future of the cannabis industry. All right, Chelsea, I am super excited for today's episode because both of us have been basically Instagram stalking today's guest for a while, and she's so cool. Like, we just want to talk to her.
I wouldn't call it like stalking. She's a very prominent figure on cannabis IG law.
Yes.
I don't know what that niche is, but she's very good at it. And it's hard to not follow her content.
Very true. Very true. She goes on Instagram by the name of Cannabogada, which apparently a lot of people like myself assume that it was bodega.
Yeah.
It's not. It's Bogada, which is lawyer in Spanish. So yeah, she's a pretty popular young woman, Jessica Gonzalez. She is pretty much known throughout like the cannabis like law space, especially on the East Coast. She is a resident of New Jersey, but she is of Ecuadorian descent, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. And she's really like one of the, I would say like founding community of cannabis lawyers in this space. I mean, obviously it's such a nascent industry and obviously the law arm of it is even like newer. But she's really created her own, you know, niche in this space and like her own like voice of authority. And it's paying off because like, I think High Times just named her on like one of their most influential lists. She's like on all of these like very prominent industry leader lists. And so, you know, really the sky's the limit for her career.
Exactly. I mean, when you make the High Times list, you're pretty badass at this point. And obviously, you know, her being a resident of New Jersey is pretty kind of essential right now because New Jersey just allowed recreational sales of cannabis on April 21st, right after the most important cannabis holidays, 420. And apparently the lines were out of this world and money was made.
Yeah. So on opening day, over 12,000 people. That's a lot of people. And it's like less than 10 dispensaries too. And
which is insane to me.
Yeah. Nearly $2 million spent just on the 21st. And apparently that momentum carried through the weekend. Clearly there is demand, but, Jess has said in other interviews that she is not going to be in those lines in Jersey for now to buy legal weed. So I am interested to hear more on why that's the case and what kind of business community she wants to give her money to.
Yes. And you know what? I really liked that, you know, she has been pretty much in the forefront of making sure that people of color and social equity applicants really get a fair chance at building their own cannabis businesses, because we know, you know, a lot of these mega corporations, they have easier access to capital, right? They have connects and resources at their fingertips, whereas a lot of these, you know, individuals, they don't quite have that. So I'm really excited to hear about like what exactly she's doing to help, I guess, the little person or whatever you want to call it, the individual, to really kind of get their footing in the cannabis space.
Yeah. And it's also worth mentioning that she was part of like the coalition that helped pass adult use like on the referendum level in the 2020 November election in Jersey. So she is in the ear of, well, not maybe not like closely in the ear of the regulators, but she's been advocating for an equitable market. And like, she is well aware of like the funny business and the not so great things about this sector, especially in her own home state. So it's really refreshing to see someone with like, you know, provide like volunteer their skills and are so passionate about this issue and like is so successful at this.
Agreed. And before we jump in and talk to Jessica, we would be remiss to not let everyone know that we went to our first bud trimming party the other day. Shout out to the Cola
Op. That's right.
Yeah, the Cola Co-op. They invited us. We had, first of all, I don't think me or you have heard anything about bud trimming parties. So this was pretty dope.
I had no idea what to expect.
Neither did I. But it was pretty cool. We, you know, we went to this nice, like, I guess we would say, like, I don't know if it was like a penthouse or whatnot in the city. It was like in Midtown. And
it's like an event space.
Very cool event space. Yeah, it was pretty cool. They had like a kitchen, like industrial kind of commercial kitchen, where they had, people cook like infused dinner for us. And then we also were given a jar of marijuana, where we had
a literal mason jar.
Yeah. Mason jar, where we basically had to kind of like trim the leaves off of the bud so that we can, you know, grind it and roll it up and smoke it ourselves. And that was pretty fun. So shout out to the Cola Co-op for inviting High Priority to attend. We can't wait to check out the next event. All right. And now that we have gotten that quick little shout out the way, let's go ahead and talk to Miss Jessica Gonzalez Esquire, cannabis and intellectual property attorney at Hiller PC and outside general counsel for minorities for medical marijuana.
Welcome, Jessica. You are one of the most prominent legal voices in the cannabis business community and also played a critical role in New Jersey's legalization process. For our listeners who might not be as familiar with your work, can you give us a brief overview of your background, understand what drew you to cannabis law, especially when the industry was relatively nascent when you were still in school?
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you so much for having me. So I've been involved in the cannabis industry now for a little over 5 years, which is pretty much about 90% of my legal career. And so what initially drew me to cannabis law was back really in 2017 when Governor Murphy of New Jersey was running on a campaign for his two W's, weed and wages. And when I first heard about this, I was only in my first year of being an attorney, and I wasn't particularly thrilled with the work that I was doing. I was mostly in the music space, entertainment space, and for, you know, those outside looking in, it could seem like a very sexy job, but it wasn't an industry I was particularly passionate about. I loved doing intellectual property, but I just didn't really enjoy the industry. And so when cannabis was on the horizon here in New Jersey, and it seemed like a very real possibility, I decided this is a good chance to get involved with a plant that I really believed in that has saved me more ways than one. And I've been smoking weed since I'm 17 years old. So it's something that I was very familiar with and just a plant that was quite personal to me. And that's when I pivoted using intellectual property to get into the cannabis industry. And I started working with brands, you know, from around the country, and my practice grew from there to compliance, business transactions, and of course, a ton of advocacy.
Nice. I love that. That's such a, like, it sounds like a smooth, like, introduction, like, into the space, but I'm sure there was a lot of stuff that happened behind the scenes, but thanks for sharing that. In previous interviews, you've mentioned that you come from a long line of healers and how you've used cannabis as a plant medicine for over a decade. How has cannabis helped you throughout your life and career, and how has the relationship impacted how you approach your legal and advocacy work?
Sure. So, you know, I'm an immigrant of this country. I came from Ecuador when I was 3 years old, and I became a citizen of this country when I was 8 years old. So I had to be the first to do a lot of things, first to graduate from a private university, first to go to law school, first to own my own business. And when you're the first to do many of these things, there's no map or there's no guidance really along the way. And that comes with enormous amount of pressure and anxiety. And especially when you're just trying to make your immigrant family proud, make sure that their sacrifices are not in vain. So cannabis entered my life when I was 17, and I realized that all of this information that we were receiving about this plant was completely inaccurate. You know, it wasn't something that made me out of control. It wasn't something that I felt, you know, was dangerous at all. And so I began to use it therapeutically to help me deal both with the loneliness of going to college and being away from home, the pressures of being the first, navigating university, navigating law school, working two jobs in college, working three jobs before law school. So I really used it for a lot of its therapeutic benefits just to get me through and keep me sane. And the fact is I had this really lovely relationship with the plant. And then when I entered the cannabis space, as I mentioned previously, I didn't realize the history of cannabis. I didn't realize how deep it was. And I was not aware of a lot of the racial discrimination and the prejudices that have really haunted this plant and this industry. So I would consider myself to have been an uninformed consumer. And once I began to learn about why cannabis was criminalized in the first place and the communities that it, you know, it was weaponized against, that's when I really became a vocal advocate for social equity and social justice, you know, here in New Jersey, because I started to realize that the rooms that I was entering in and the panels that I was presenting on were primarily white. And I began to notice that despite the fact that it was communities of color who were really pushing for legalization, it was those same communities that were being excluded from the industry. So using, you know, the plant and my personal relationship to it and just the appreciation that I had coupled with the fact that I just learned about the history of it really helped fuel a lot of my motivation to be vocal for the communities that have historically been silenced.
I love that. Did your parents have like a certain or instill anything particular in your brain about cannabis growing up?
Absolutely. So in my, you know, very immigrant community, my family's from Ecuador, it's still over there, you know, considered to be a bit criminal. And so even growing up, I was taught that this was a plant only for criminals. And if you consumed it, you automatically either should have been in jail. You just came out of jail. You were dealing with a dangerous crowd. I remember when they found my cousin's bong for the first time and it became this whole family debacle and everybody found out about it. And my sister and I had to act shocked. We were like, oh God, really? You know, a bong is found in this room.
Oh but my, how did that get?
Right. Exactly. And I used to advocate actually for it at a lot of family dinners and family events, such that before we would go to a Christmas dinner or Thanksgiving dinner, my mom would say, Mija, please, this time, don't talk about cannabis. And I would say, well, I won't talk about it, but if they start coming at me with wrong facts, it's my obligation to correct them. And so I did that almost for 7 years. And one day my mother asked me, she said, listen, I want to know, do you consume? You seem so passionate about this plant. Do you consume? And I asked her, you know the saying, don't ask the question if you don't want the answer? And she said, got it, then don't answer my question. So if you can imagine, you know, what it was like to tell, you know, my mother who just sacrificed everything for me to be here and to go to school, hey, mom, I'm entering the cannabis space. Hey, by the way, there's not really such thing as cannabis lawyers right now. So I'm going to quit my job at a law firm. I'm going to start my own law firm so that I can get involved in this industry. By the way, mom, it is not legal in New Jersey, nor is it legal on the federal level. So telling my entire family that was very shocking to them because they had never, you know, they had their assumptions, but they never really knew until I started to get involved. So for really about 6 months of my involvement in the cannabis industry, nobody asked me about my job. They would ask me everything else, but nobody spoke about it. It was sort of like, just don't ask, don't tell, nothing like that. But it wasn't until my family started to see a lot of my success, they started to see me on panels, they started to see me on magazines, that they actually started to realize like, hey, she's actually making a really nice profession for herself. And I think when it comes to the immigrant community, especially in the Latino community, professionalism is really important. So I professionalized this plant, and that's how I was really able to get them to understand that this is not a drug, but it was a medicine, and that it is decades and decades of brainwashing that worked perfectly to make them understand that this was a medicinal product and that it could actually work. And so now the entire family is on board. Everybody asks me for the special chocolates on Christmas and on Thanksgiving. My family, you know, has been using it for pain relief, for sleeping, for any sort of trauma or grief. So I essentially end up becoming, you know, the black sheep of the family to the family pharmacist.
That's incredible. And I think your story too of like paving your own path and just being a consumer and like seeing the success in your own career, hopefully that inspires even more, you know, lawyers of color or other immigrants who want to get into the space.
Yeah, absolutely. I just keep telling folks, you just have to do you, and everybody who matters will fall in line eventually. So I'm really happy that I took a big risk on myself, you know, about 5 or 6 years ago. And it was definitely difficult, you know, in the beginning. But now my mother told me one day, she said, this was the best decision you could have ever made for yourself. Wow. She's like, and I'm so proud that you did. because wow. I remember when I was 17 years old, she told me something that I have always kept. And she said, you have to fight for what you want, even if you have to fight me. So I took that and I made sure that I always kept that really in the back of my mind, that whatever it is that I wanted to do, even if I had to fight with my own family, that was going to be what I had to do.
Wow.
I think I love
That's
your mom.
That's really
already.
Impactful. I know. Wow. I think your mom is like the hero in all of this.
Wow. That's
amazing. Yeah. So as someone who started their career specializing in intellectual property law, what would you say are the most common mistakes that cannabis business owners make in this area?
So great question, because it brings me back to when I first started. And when I started going to a lot of trade shows, industry shows, networking events, and I would see all of these really cool logos and really awesome brand names. And I would ask every single person, how are they protecting their intellectual property? And every single person would tell me, oh, well, it's my social media handle. Oh, well, I own the domain name. Oh, well, it's my LLC name. And all of them mistakenly assumed that because they owned a few of those assets, it automatically meant that they had trademark protection and that they were the actual owners of, you know, this trademark. And that's when I realized there was a huge disconnect between the cannabis industry and the intellectual property world. And I noticed that there were a lot of lawyers on the West Coast who were already doing a lot of this work, but I wasn't seeing it a lot on the East Coast because we just weren't as evolved just yet. And that's when I started educating folks, because I started hearing attorneys tell these people in cannabis, you can't get anything trademarked because it's cannabis related. And I remember thinking, like, that doesn't sound right. There must be a way. So I just began to study trademark applications from lawyers from the West Coast, like Shabnam Malek and Mary Shapiro and Luke Zimmerman. And that's when I started to learn that there is a way. You just have to be a little bit creative. So the most common mistake that I see is, one, they begin using a name when a proper trademark clearance report wasn't done in the first place. So they choose a name, they begin investing in design, they begin investing in social media assets, they begin investing in graphics, but they never actually consulted with an attorney to make sure that that name was even available for them to use. So now they're potentially committing trademark infringement, and rebranding is an extremely, extremely expensive endeavor. So there's this wrong assumption. So for the folks listening on here, if you have the social media name, if you have the LLC name, if you have the domain name, none of that on its own constitutes trademark protection because it's not commercial in nature. So the first thing to do is you have to make sure that that mark is available for use. And then if so, apply for federal trademark protection.
Interesting. So I know you said that basically the federal government isn't working with plant touching businesses right now in terms of trademarks. So how can cannabis brands protect their reputation if they are plant touching and like build that consumer goodwill in the interim?
Sure. So the United States Patent and Trademark Office that has the US in the beginning of its name means that it's a federal agency. So they don't particularly give a shit of what's happening on the state level. They just care about what's happening on the federal level. So they're looking at the FDA, they're looking at the DEA. And both of them are saying, sorry, cannabis is still federally illegal, so we can't actually provide you with federal trademark protection for your plant touching goods or services. So what we have to do is we have to attempt to trademark everything that is ancillary to their plant touching goods or services. So what I tell clients and how I advise them is, all right, let's take a look. You are dispensing adult use cannabis, but what else are you doing that surrounds that? You are providing education. You are providing advocacy. You may be providing consulting services. You may be selling smoker articles. You may be selling apparel. So when we're looking at all these other things that they're doing, we trademark all of those other goods or services in an attempt to create what I call a halo of protection against the plant touching services. So we build a strong enough trademark portfolio surrounding the plant touching good or service with the hopes that it will protect it when the time comes. Because when the time comes that federal prohibition is lifted, we will be already have 4 or 5 trademark registrations for other ancillary parts. So it's going to be a lot more of a smoother ride to get it for the plant touching good or services. We saw this when it happened with CBD and hemp back in December of 2018 and how the USPTO handled that. We expect that they're going to handle it in the same way that they did it for hemp. So it's the same strategy. Create a really strong trademark portfolio now to rely upon when federal prohibition is lifted.
Wow.
That makes a lot of sense. Oh my gosh. Yeah. You're literally dropping gems for free. So for all the high priority listeners right now, you're welcome. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it turns out you don't even have to have like a product, or you don't have to be up and running to even get a trademark. You just have to, do the audit.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So when you file for trademark protection, it's always in connection with a good or service, right? So it's commercial in nature. And so you have to sell it in interstate commerce. And that is why plant touching goods can't get it, because you can't sell cannabis from New York to New Jersey. And in order to get trademark protection, you need two things. The mark needs to be distinct, meaning it has to be unique. Nobody else can be using it within your channel of commerce. And two, it has to be used in interstate commerce. It has to be sold in interstate commerce. So that's why when I go back to the mistakes that folks make, is they think that their trademark is unique, but that's only because they haven't done a proper search. And most of the time, you may think that it is, you know, that your idea is the bee's knees and that that name is the coolest name and nobody else could have come up with it. That's likely not the case. And so we have to make sure that that name is distinct. And then two, that you can sell or offer your services across state lines. And that's the reason why cannabis will never be able to fulfill that second one of interstate commerce until federal prohibition is lifted.
So interesting.
Which God knows when that's going to happen, because we thought Biden was going to do it, but probably not.
Next the terms question. Are coming up. We'll see.
I won't hold my breath. So we all know that cost of capital is most certainly one of the greatest barriers to entry into this industry. So that unfortunately applies to legal fees as well. For a lot of aspiring cannabis business owners, either on the plant touching side or the ancillary side, what percent of their upfront operating costs should be allocated to legal fees?
Sure. So I'm going to give the very annoying legal answer of it depends, right? The percentage will depend on the type of license that they're applying for. Is it plant touching? Is it non-plant touching? Does it require a license? Does it not require a license? All of that will really implicate how high the legal fees are. Also, you know, if you're going for a license in a particular state, is it a competitive-based licensing scheme? That will also increase the cost as well. But there should be a line item in your budget that is dedicated to legal. And likely, I would say, you know, if you are on the plant touching side and you're trying to go, you know, for a license, like you could be looking, you know, at the very least, just depending on the type of license, you know, anywhere from around, you know, $75,000 to about $250,000. And if it's, you know, a very competitive where we can only take on one, then it can exceed that. So folks really need to set aside a solid amount of their budget for legal, because everybody doesn't anticipate a lot of legal transactions that need to happen, from your business formation to your investment documents, your partnership documents, your intellectual property, to the compliance, you know, that it takes, to your lease agreements, to your term sheets. There's so much that is involved that a lot of folks don't believe is part of the process, but everything has to be papered, because these licensing schemes are typically, you know, require a high level of compliance. And as long as we have very hyper-regulated cannabis markets on the state level, legal fees are always going to be high, because we have to navigate between different documents, different governing bodies, different governing agencies. So there is an enormous amount of work. It's typically pretty, you know, heavy lifts. But, you know, what I am seeing on the legal end are a lot of law firms moving towards a flat fee basis as opposed to a billable hour model. And that's something that we at the firm provide, is more flat fee based pricing in order to provide that pricing stability and transparency.
Now, I just want to be clear. You said starting at $75,000?
It could, for if you're going for a license. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, all right. Save accordingly, future entrepreneurs.
And depends on your state, right? If you're, you know, somewhere like Oklahoma, where it's just, you know, a couple of pages and you need just, you're good to go, you know, then it would be different. But if you're on the East Coast where I'm located, then, oh, absolutely.
Wow.
Okay.
That is really
grandma, your uncle, your cousins, everybody.
Your Instagram network. So you've also dedicated a lot of your own time to educational panels and webinars for social equity candidates. What do you believe are the most accessible legal resources available today? And is there a legal checklist that all social equity applicants should have in the back of their minds before they start their own business?
So I guess this will really depend on the state of where they are in terms of if their commissions, cannabis commissions or anything like that, are providing such legal resources. I know that here in New Jersey, they definitely did, you know, provide a checklist. But in terms of how we, you know, talk to clients, like let's say who are applying for a particular license in a state, we're looking at four buckets. And that's how we really analyze how ready are they for this application and how much work they really need to do. And so if you're looking at four buckets, and this is going to apply, you know, it could apply really in any business, but really in particular to cannabis licensing, you know, the four buckets are starting with funding. Do you have the funding to really get this going? Two, do you have the team available? And that's not just limited to, you know, your owners and employees or consultants, but also to your professional service providers, your lawyers, your accountants, your architects, your contractors, all of that. Then there's site control. Do you have property? Do you have a place where you're going to be able to operate whatever type of cannabis establishment you are applying for a license for? Do you have the proof of local control that's typically required as well? And then the last is your intellectual property. Do you have your trademarks in place, your copyrights in place? Are there any patents you're applying for? Are there any trade secrets that could be in the form of, you know, standard operating procedures or distribution lists or things like that? So those are the four buckets that everybody should really be focusing on. And we get a lot of inquiries, you know, where can we start? What are we going to need? If everybody focuses on those four buckets, they should be okay, and they should at least be able to assess where they are in the process and how much farther they need to go.
Okay, that was very, very, very helpful. While we're still on the topic of social equity, you were a member of the Social Impact Committee for the New Jersey Can 2020, the coalition that was able to legalize cannabis via the state referendum in 2020. What were the social equity provisions that you and your team advocated for? And do you believe that regulators have created the proper infrastructure to deliver on those commitments?
Sure. So yes, I led the Social Impact Committee for NJ Can, and it ended up being the most successful cannabis legalization campaign in the country, with over 67% of residents voting in favor. And some of the policies that we were really rooting for and that we were really advocating for was, one, we advocated for non-competitive licensing. We didn't want, you know, one applicant to be compared to another applicant. We wanted it to be, you score the requisite amount of points, you are automatically approved for licensure. Historically, in New Jersey, our three rounds in 2012, 2018, and 2019 were all competitive licensing schemes. They said, we are only awarding a certain amount of licenses, and it's competitive, meaning you will be graded against everybody else. So whoever scores the highest, those are the ones that are going to get approved. We advocated for non-competitive licensing, and we were able to achieve that. The only competitive licenses right now are the cultivation licenses, but that's actually going to expire in less than a year. What we also advocated for was lower application fees. So in New Jersey, the cost to apply was $20,000, and it was $2,000 non-refundable, $18,000 refundable if you weren't awarded a license. But you still need to have that money in the bank, and they still needed to cash that check. So $20,000 just to apply. We advocated to lower that significantly. So now it doesn't exceed $1,000 for you to apply.
Oh, wow.
That's so a huge very difference. Huge difference. Yes, absolutely. What we also advocated for was for a social equity applicant status. We wanted to make sure that we took into consideration the folks who were harmed by cannabis prohibition, those who were arrested or who had a close family member arrested as well. What we also advocated for was a priority system. We wanted to make sure that minority-owned businesses, diversely-owned businesses, social equity applicants, impact zone businesses, all of them had a priority when it came to being scored for completeness and then being scored for approval. And now we have this type of priority licensing, which means, let's say, you know, in week one, a non-minority or non-social equity applicant applies, and then you as a minority or social equity applicant applies in 3 weeks, it's as if you would have applied the first week. And what this does is it provides applicants with ample time to prepare so that they're not rushed. Because typically the folks who are readily prepared to submit an application as soon as the window opens are the well-capitalized, you know, multi-state operators. So we wanted to make sure that folks had the time and the resources necessary to put forth a complete application. What we also advocated for was no application windows. Typically in New Jersey, you were given about 5 to 6 weeks to submit an application, and that was it. And you didn't know when the application period opened until it was like 2 or 3 days before. So unless you had a lobbyist or a lawyer to really keep their ear to the ground and be friendly with the folks at the state capitol, you had no idea when this application period was dropping. So imagine all of a sudden you find out in two to three days, an application period is going to open and it's going to close in 5 weeks. The only folks who would be ready to do that are the folks who are well capitalized and who already have previous, you know, applications and previous operations in another state. So now in New Jersey, they opened up the application process with no end date. They will let us know within 30 days. They'll give us a 30 days notice as to when they're going to close the application window. So in New Jersey, one opened up December 15th for cultivators and processors and labs. That is still open. So we're about 5 months in and that is still open. It opened up for retail in March 15th, and there's no indication as to when they're going to close it. What we also advocated for were no caps. We didn't want any caps on the number of licenses in New Jersey. So we only have caps on the cultivation, but no caps on anywhere else. So it is completely up to the discretion of the commission. But as long as you receive that requisite score, you are going to be approved for licensure. So those were a few things that we advocated for that we were very successful on.
Wow, what a difference that makes. I know. It's like night and day.
Absolutely.
It almost makes you think, like, why wasn't those things already in the initial, like, proposal? Like, to me, it kind of sounds like nonsensical. Like, yeah, wouldn't you want to give people a chance to get the money, apply, and, you know, be, you know, ready?
Lobbying. Yeah. Corporate lobbying. Yeah.
Doing God's work over here in New Jersey. So on the topic of retail licenses coming out, adult use sales may have started in New Jersey 2 weeks ago, but only MSOs secured the first round of retail licenses, and they were all medical operators to start with. How can minority-owned cannabis businesses or social equity applicants foster consumer relationships and build brand recognition while waiting for licensing approval?
Yes. So the medical operators here in New Jersey had first bite at the apple, and 7 of the 12 medical operators were approved to expand to adult use. And that happened correctly about 2 weeks ago. And in terms of how minority cannabis businesses can really start what they're doing, I think that they're actually going to be at an advantage when this actually opens up, because there's really it's not a secret here in New Jersey that folks are not particularly pleased with the medical operators. The medical operators have held a monopoly in New Jersey for far too long. The prices are extremely high and there is very little product diversification. Competition is going to breed lower prices, and it's going to ensure and it's going to motivate these companies to come up with different products. Because right now, what incentive do they have if they know they are the only ones that are able to sell this? So I think right now what we're seeing is an initial excitement, but I think that initial excitement is going to start waning as soon as these standalone operators are going to be able to enter the game, because they're going to be members of the community who have been fostering these relationships for years, especially legacy operators who already have their consumer base and they already have the brand recognition. Should they decide, you know, to move forward into the regulated area, I think that they would be extremely successful because of the amount of goodwill that they have garnered over the years. I can't really say with any level of certainty that these medical operators have any goodwill. It's just right now they are the only option, but that's not going to be the case, you know, moving forward. So what I just tell my applicants and my clients to do is, you know, keep talking to press, get your brand out there, you know, start doing educational platforms, start educating your community, start making relationships with other applicants who are applying. If you're going for cultivation, start making relationships with retailers. If you are a retailer, start making relationships with processors and cultivators, and start, you know, leveraging a lot of your community network to really help propel you forward. And I think that's what's going to move a lot of these companies forward, is the fact that the community is going to show out in support. Like I, for example, you will not catch me in any of these lines. I will wait until the standalone minority-owned operators are up and running, and that will be the day that I celebrate with my dollar bills. Until then, I'm just going to continue to support my legacy operators.
I'm not upset with that. And I feel like a lot of people share your sentiments as well. So shout out to the legacy operators, your weed guy, your weed girl. Mm-hmm. We support you still.
Yeah. And I looked at some of those menus, like a pack of pre-rolls for $50. I'm going to wait.
Yeah. I'll be waiting right alongside you. We kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but New Jersey is currently accepting license applications for retailers, cultivators, manufacturers, and testing labs. But there are still a number of license types waiting for their turn. What will be the licensing, or what will the licensing process look like for those remaining categories? And how can potential applicants ensure that they are fully prepared?
Sure. Yeah. So for the folks listening on here right now, class one cultivators, class two processors, class five retailers and testing labs are available. But the ones that are still remaining are the class three wholesalers, the class four distributors, and the class six delivery operators. And right now, unfortunately, the regulations that were adopted August 19, 2021 of last year did not include those three license types. It didn't also include consumption lounges. It didn't talk about commercial kitchens. It didn't talk about edibles. So what I think I need folks to understand is the regulations that we have are incomplete. And the reason incompleteness is because the commission had a deadline that was set by the statute. It wasn't set by them. And there's a lot of confusion out there saying that the commission is missing all of its self-imposed deadlines. These are not self-imposed. These were imposed by the legislators, and they created these deadlines before a commission existed. So the commission has to act within the purview of that statute. So they had a deadline of August 21st. They met their deadline August 19th with the caveat that these regulations are incomplete. So there is a good thing to note. These regulations are only good for 1 year, meaning we will get new regulations coming August. And these new regulations are going to be subject to public comment. The first iteration of regulations that we're working with now were exempt from public comment. So the day that the public saw it, August 19th, was the day that those regulations were adopted, meaning there was very little input from the public. So in terms of how folks can really start getting prepared right now, the application process is likely going to look very, very similar to what we're seeing now. There's a governing document called the Notice of Application Acceptance, and it's about 30 pages, and it sets forth the priority process, and it sets forth exactly what you need for each type of license that you're applying for. So if anybody wants to take a look at what they need to do to prepare, you just need to look at that notice of application. And if it says, you know, SOPs for cultivation, you know that it's going to be SOPs for wholesalers. And if it says, you know, security for cultivation, you know it's going to be security for wholesalers or distributors or delivery. We may see some things that are a little bit more unique to these different types of license types, but there's a lot of information already there for you to get going. So what folks really need to do to make sure that they're prepared is they need to read that document. They need to read it backwards and forwards, and it's the Notice of Application Acceptance. So if you don't want to read through 200 pages of a statute, and you don't want to read through 160 pages of regulations, you can read through a 30-page document that sets forth exactly what you need. And then you just got to go back to the four buckets that I spoke about and really focus on those four. Those four will guide and inform the application you're looking to prepare.
Okay, this is good to know. They literally, Jessica's giving you guys keys to the kingdom. So listen.
All this stuff to run your life better. Wow. So I guess speaking of things that are like still in flux and just the challenges of adult use rollout, cannabis obviously is legal at the state level in New Jersey, but it appears that municipal opposition is now impeding this whole process. How are high municipal opt-out rates creating more barriers to entry? And is there a way for regulators and industry stakeholders to constructively address this issue?
This is a great question because I do feel that unfortunately it's not talked about often. And if you're looking through headlines that are talking about New Jersey's cannabis industry, a lot of times people are gunning for the Cannabis Regulatory Commission and they're targeting their frustrations and their disappointments to the commission. And I keep informing these folks, your frustration is misplaced because what you really should be frustrated at are these municipalities. So right now in New Jersey, we have 565 municipalities. Only about 100 have really opted in. And it doesn't mean that they've opted in for every type of license. They can sort of do this a la carte method and choose which types of licenses they want allowed within their borders. But if we recall, you know, when I advocated for non-competitive licensing and no caps. We are seeing both of that on the municipal level. When I advocated for low application fees, municipalities are charging anywhere from $5,000 to $15,000 just to apply. And when we're talking about priority levels, there's likely very little priority for social equity and diversely owned businesses. And then what these municipalities, you know, are doing is they now have their own application process. So now applicants don't just need to look at the cost to apply on the state level. You need to now look at what it's going to cost you to apply in the municipal level. And some of these municipalities are, you know, what I advocated for is, listen, municipalities, if you want to have your own application process, go right ahead, but try to mirror what the state is requiring so that applicants don't have to do, you know, a duplicate effort. But some of them are going completely rogue and instituting their own endorsement requirements, and they have the discretion to put forth whatever endorsement requirements they want. So now you're not just abiding by the state's guidelines and regulations. You now need to look at what your municipal ordinance is requiring, and it could be vastly different. So if we're talking about heightening barriers to entry, now there's higher application fees. Now there's caps on the municipal level. I know some cities that are saying we will only allow one dispensary, one cultivator, one processor. I know ones that are capping it at five. There are some, you know, that are outliers that are not capping it. For example, Jersey City, where I was raised and where I live, doesn't have a cap, but other towns have caps. Other towns have also had an application process that was open for a month. I've seen ones that have an application period open for 2 or 3 weeks and then it closes. And it's not like they are alerting the public that this is happening. So what we're seeing are high fees, competitive licensing schemes, restrictive zoning, but most importantly, a complete lack of transparency as to how this is going down and an unequal application of these ordinances to all applicants. So I know that there's even a potential lawsuit brewing on the municipal level and one in South Jersey because folks went to a municipality, asked about the application process, was told that there was none, and then found out a few weeks later that one applicant was approved for licensure within that municipality.
Oh, that's terrible.
So, So in order to, you know, address this issue, what I have been setting forth to the commission is start, you know, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, who has the power to do this and maybe what penalties can be enacted if municipalities don't, but mandate that all municipalities submit their ordinances and submit their application to the commission to have in a central database where everybody can take a look. Because right now, if you want to find out if a certain city has opted in or has opted out and what their application is like, you really got to call them. You have to show up. You have to be on their asses to really ask them because it's very unclear. And when you're navigating these municipal websites, you know, they look like they were created back in the 1980s and were never updated once. So it's very difficult to navigate. Right. And so, you know, imagine the amount of time that you have to spend calling them. You have to spend, you know, asking them for these documents and you have to ask them, you know, well, have folks have been approved? And I know from some of my clients who have called these municipalities, and these municipalities will tell them, sorry, we can't tell you who's been approved. Wow. We can't tell you who has applied, you know, just yet. So how are you supposed to know if that's even a viable municipality for you? And why that's important is because the commission will not grant you a license if you don't have proof of local support. And that comes in the form of a letter or a resolution. So you need three things from a town. You need site control, so you need to actually lock down a building, whether that's a deed, whether that's a lease, whether that's, you know, a binding letter of intent. You need some formal agreement that you're gonna have final control of the property. You need zoning approval, and then you need proof of local support. So you need these three things. Without those three things, you cannot get a license. And the municipalities can also set forth their preference, which was located nowhere in the statute, but it showed up in the regulations that all of a sudden they can provide preference. So what this tells me is you're setting up a breeding ground for predatory practices and you're setting up a breeding ground for bribery.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's like, well, if you didn't line the pockets of a certain councilman or a certain mayor, you may not actually get the approval that you need. So there's a lot that's happening on the municipal level that I just don't feel is talked about just because of the fact that it is decentralized and we have these 565, you know, mini governments doing, you know, whatever it is that they're doing. But until I think the commission really starts to come in and say, all right, listen, give us all of this information or the legislators or something happens that forces these municipalities to act, we're just going to continue to see these high barriers to entry and this highly lack of transparency.
Wow. And sorry, this might be like a dumb question, but the amount of power that these municipalities have, is that something that is just special to New Jersey, or is this kind of across the board, like experienced at all in all states?
No, we have seen it in a lot of other states. I know in Massachusetts, they had an issue because you needed to enter into like what's called a community host agreement. And some of these mayors were like, well, you got to pay us, you know, X amount of money for us to sign this agreement in the first place. You know, in 2019 in New Jersey's medical round, you didn't need a letter. All you needed to show was an ordinance from that town that they were going to allow cannabis operations. And that was all you needed. And now in this adult use round, you need all these other layers of approval, but how you get that approval is still unclear because even some of these municipalities are still changing their ordinances and they're still changing their application processes on a daily basis. So how to keep track of that? It's difficult.
That's rough.
Gosh, I mean, well, I'm sure transparency and more centralized processes is probably going to be a part of your answer to this next question. But what do you hope New Jersey's cannabis industry will look like in 5 years? And what current or future regulations will make this possible?
Well, in the next 5 years, I just hope to see, you know, I hope to see a lot of craft growers. I hope to see a lot of minority owned businesses. I hope to see a lot of local New Jersey entrepreneurs just really thriving in this space as well. But what I also hope to see is an influx of ancillary service providers in the cannabis industry as well. Because what a lot of folks don't know is that it's the ancillary market is 2 times the size of the plant touching market because there's enormous amount of support that is necessary for these licenses and these operations to really thrive and succeed and grow. So I hope that we see a lot more people applying for these licenses. I hope to see the barriers to entry lower. I hope that municipalities really lower their own barriers to entry and sort of get on board. I hope that a lot of them begin to opt in, which I think they will. I think right now, a lot of folks are still skeptical, a little bit conservative. They're not really, they're a little unclear on the regulations. They don't know what to do. But I feel like as soon as they start seeing all of that tax revenue come in, a lot of them are going to be, you know, it's going to start opting in because one thing that you can't ban in New Jersey, you can ban every type of license, but you can't ban the delivery of cannabis and cannabis products within a town. So for a lot of these towns, when I'm speaking to them and I'm trying to bring them over to the bright side, I always tell them, listen, you can't ban the delivery. So your constituents are going to be consuming. You're just not going to be, you know, receiving the benefit of any tax revenue. So it likely behooves you to allow these operators to be in here so that you can benefit and your community can benefit. So I think we'll see a lot of that as well. But mostly what I want to see is just a lower level of compliance of what's necessary for a lot of these companies, because New Jersey and even New York are going to be hyper-regulated cannabis markets. And even the regulations that we've seen are very different from what we've seen in other states that have initially rolled out adult use programs. And a lot of it, I think, is backed by good intentions. But in practicality, the more regulations, the more laws, the more compliance, the more professional services somebody's going to need to hire in order to help them navigate that.
Very true. I'm wondering, if you weren't a cannabis lawyer, what other position within the cannabis industry would you fill?
So I would love to be a teacher. I really would love to do a lot more education, which is why the speaking engagement, the podcast, everything like that is probably my favorite part of the job. And what I like to do is I like to learn from my own clients. And then I like to be able to tell the stories to other folks, you know, that I'm on stage with, to really start arming them with the tools they need to start in this industry and succeed. So the type of person, you know, that I would like to be is, if you ever watched in movies, it's like the folks who are giving like the shields and the swords and then saying, good luck. That's the type of person that I wish to be. Here's your sword. Here's your shield. Good luck. I've given you what you need to know. Go and do you. that's the role that I would like to play. It's more teacher, consultant, guidance. So I hope eventually to be able to get into, you know, academia. I hope to be able to do sort of more, you know, writing and reporting on, you know, what's going on. Right now, my job is a little hectic, so it's difficult to make the time to do a lot of this. But that's really where my passions lie. I mean, I'm a Gemini. I'm born under the sign of communication. And so what I always just want to do is talk to people and just arm them with the tools that they need.
Wow. Well, the industry definitely needs like 1,000 more of you. So keep going at it. This is incredible. So I think this is a good point for us to end the serious part of our interview and get to the fun part. So we're going into I Got Five on It, which is just where we ask the fun questions. These are rapid fire, just whatever comes to the top of your mind. So question number one, if you could infuse cannabis into any food or drink, what would it be?
Ooh, easy. It would be a hot chocolate. So I have a hot chocolate every single morning. I make it out of dates and cashews. I blend it all up into this mixture. I can't give all the ingredients, my trade secret, but I have it every single morning. And so a lot of folks who try it are always telling me, hey, can you give me your recipe? I'd love to infuse it, you know, with something that's something perhaps, you know, down the line. But cacao is really, you know, an important product of Ecuador, you know, where I'm from. And so I've always grew up with a lot of this like raw cacao, chocolate, organic cacao, and that's sort of what I use. So that's what it would be, my hot chocolate for sure. Wow. What I wake up for.
Now, okay, now Jessica, you have to tell us off air. I need to know. Next question. What is your ideal setting to enjoy cannabis?
I like to be inside, and it comes as a lot of surprise to folks when I tell them that I am very much an introvert, and a lot of people think that I like to be, you know, out there. And while I do need my space, but I really like to be, you know, inside, smoking a J with my TV, you know, with my hot chocolate or a hot beverage or something, you know, of that nature. That's really my ideal setting, is like my living room, my couch, friends, family, or my partner.
I love that. Chill.
Super.
What is your biggest cannabis related pet peeve?
Oh, yes. I do not like smoking blunts or J's without filters. It kills me whenever somebody rolls without filters. It just gets sort of mushy, and then it closes and I can't really inhale it properly. Yeah. And it's a little, you know, you got chapstick on there, you got lip gloss, the whole thing. So filters are very big for me. And I think I've been spoiled because my partner is just an excellent roller and he's always used filters. So whenever I'm in circles and there's no filters, I'm always like, oh God, I just have to whip out my own at this point.
You're like, that no, we're past this. Okay. Elevate yourselves, people.
Those are also the joints I was rolling back in like 2014. And I'm not proud of that. So
good. It's all good. We all learn.
Yeah. Exactly. Everything is a growing experience.
Exactly. There you go. No pun intended. If you could smoke with any celeb, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
So it's between two. Dead, it would be Carl Jung, the psychologist. Just really love, you know, his work and all the thing about the collective, subconscious, and archetypes. I think we'd have a fabulous, fabulous conversation. Nice. And then alive, it would be a singer by the name of Manu Chao. And he sings a lot about cannabis in a lot of his songs. And I just think me and him would just have a very chill time just dissecting some of his lyrics and just his sort of own path. And also Pablo Coelho as well, who is my favorite author. I think I would just love to pick his brain about his experiences and how he wrote the books that he did.
Okay, so she's Lovely. An intellectual smoker, okay?
I know, yeah.
I read constantly. I am. I'm crushing books all the time.
Okay, I
that is why you excelled in law school.
Exactly.
You're not
exactly. You are killing it for both of us.
Yeah. And last question, what is one rule you set for yourself when you're high?
My one rule, I don't drink. So I'm not a big drinker, but the one thing that I won't do is I will not drink if I'm consuming. Not that I really have sort of, you know, any bad experience, but especially sort of, you know, when I'm out, I'm very protective of myself and my surroundings. And I know that I can control myself way more if it's just, you know, on cannabis. That way, if something happens, I know exactly, you know, what was the reason for it. So I don't ever mix the two.
Very, very smart. Would you say that you have like, because you mainly consume cannabis and not alcohol, would you say you have like a high tolerance? Because for me, like 2.5 milligrams, I'm good. Like I don't need anything else past that. You know, if we get to 5, that's great. If we get past that, I'm on the floor.
I do. I would say I have a high tolerance for certain types of edibles. For smoking, mm-hmm. definitely. I can definitely just sort of like keep going. For edibles, though, it's different. Chocolates affect me differently. I'm not a huge fan of anything that's like gummy or sour or anything mm-hmm. like that. I think I prefer edibles that have the fat in them. It just works with my body better. So cookies, brownies, chocolates, things like that. I try to typically stay away from like the gummies and the sour candies that are more, you know, with sort of sugar alcohols. They just don't jive well with me. And those I have less of a tolerance to.
Interesting. Okay.
I never knew that could be metabolized different. Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to experiment later.
Right. Now I want to experiment.
Yeah, yeah, because I'm like a gummy person, yeah, but maybe I'll look into this.
I know, like
chocolates are my favorite way of consuming edibles. Those are the best.
And see, I don't have like easy access to chocolates. I have more like easy access to gummies. So now I do want to like experiment more and check out like the chocolates and the brownies and see if I like my body reacts differently, like you said yours does. Very interesting.
Yeah, try it out. Let me know.
All right. Well, Jessica, this was great. Before we let you go, how and where can our listeners find you?
So best is my Instagram. So Cannabogada, CannaBogada. Most people think it is Cannabodega. It is not. It is Cannabogada, which stands for cannabis lawyer in Spanish.
I will say I did thought it was.
I've made that mistake.
Yeah. I was like, wait, no, I think it's Bogada because Bogada is lawyer in Spanish. Ah, okay.
Yes.
I don't speak Spanish, so I just made it's that totally very fine. Stupid association.
It's fine. I've been meaning to make a post about it of like, listen, guys, this is what this means. Every single person, even I'm on stages, they always say, you know, it's Canna Bodega is here. And I'm like, well,
no.
Also a cool name, just not what I am.
Maybe your future dispensary,
right?
Exactly. Yes. Look at us just prophesying on high priority.
Mm-hmm. Trademark it.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Jessica, so much. We know you're a super busy lady, but we're just so glad you came on high priority and gave us some gems. You dropped a lot of knowledge for us.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely, ladies. Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
Thanks again for listening to High Priority. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Special thanks to Antoine Dry, Donald Edwards, and Jim Pryor from Dirty Soap Entertainment for our intro music. To learn more about our show and parent company, Matteo Communications, head on over to our website at matteo.com. That's matteo.com.